The surfaces are not glazed. I use underglaze. And I've tried them with glaze on. And what happens is, if they're shiny as well as highly kind of coloured and banded, all that happens is it's quite difficult to look at because the shine has quite a glare, and you kind of get vertical glare lines, kind of reflectant lines against the bands of colour that are going around. So I don't use a glaze. I just use an underglaze and keep them nice and matte, so you can read the colours and the effects. You can read the effects more easily that way.
Welcome to the Color and Ceramics Podcast. I'm Bob Acton, and I'm pleased to introduce to you the wonderful Sarah Moorhouse. Her work on ceramics, color, and spatial perception began with a master's degree at Cardiff in Wales, and then on to a PhD to develop the ideas with more emphasis upon spatial color phenomena on a three-dimensional form. She went beyond the basics of color theory and tested out ideas on the conical form. She found that colors behave differently when viewed across three-dimensional space rather than on a two-dimensional surface, particularly on the inner bowl form where illusions can appear much stronger. And Sarah and I talked about a job she had on color that will surprise you. And you can find all about her on her website at sarahmoorhouse.com. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today on the Color and Ceramics podcast. I'm super excited about you being here with your gorgeous work. So thanks very much for being here. Your work is really simply gorgeous. I have been wanting to have you on the podcast for some time because I think your work really strikes a chord with what we're trying to accomplish here around the whole notion of color and surface design. The colors and blends and vibrancy that your work really brings to the viewer is really superb. But I know that you have done a lot of work to get here today. This just didn't happen overnight. And so I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your master's and your PhD and sort of your training that got you here today.
So I was actually a teacher in my 20s, an art teacher. My first degree was in illustration, and then I did a PGCE and taught art for 6 years. But I had a lot of ceramics in my portfolio because on my foundation I'd done quite a lot of ceramics, but then decided against that route for a degree for some reason. I'm not really sure why. And then 6 years later, I decided to retrain and go back into ceramics. So I moved down to Cardiff to do an MA and just kind of had the best year. It was one of those years where everything that I'd done so far kind of came together. So, kind of typically in my past on foundation, people had said, oh, you're a 3D person. And then on my illustration years, they told me that I work well with color. So then on this 1 year, of my MA, it was kind of really all about finding myself, I suppose, and finding what excited me visually. And it wasn't until probably until about the April, May, it was a September to September course, that I had a really pivotal tutorial with a teacher that he'd only just started teaching on the MA at that point. He'd taught on it previously, but he was off teaching on textiles. And he came back and I had this tutorial and he looked at what I was doing and he said, and he listened to me kind of waffle on about this big idea. And he said, yeah, it kind of looks quite self-conscious. What did you do before? And I told him about my past and my interest in color. And I was throwing, I was doing quite a lot of throwing. I wanted to learn a skill whilst I was on the MA. And he said to me, well, you seem to like throwing and you seem to like colour. So why don't you do something with that? And I kind of went, okay. And spent the rest of the day just kind of walking around with my head in the clouds, just feeling quite relieved actually, because the things I was making before weren't right. And then the day after, I went home, slept on it. And the day after, I went into the studio and just banded a bowl without really thinking about it. And it felt nice, it felt right. And I just sort of banded it with colours just intuitively. The colours didn't really mean anything at the time. But around that time, I was doing quite a lot of travelling from Cardiff to Nottinghamshire and back because my mum was ill. So I was going home quite a lot of the weekends to see her. And the Nottinghamshire countryside had always inspired me as a child. I'd always really enjoyed the sensation of looking at ploughed lines across fields. And I also noticed how dramatically the landscape changed when the colours changed, when the seasons changed. So a field that might be kind of, brown in the winter and then speckled with little green shoots in the spring. And then a few weeks later, it'd be covered in bright yellow rapeseed. And it was just a lot bigger. The space was seemed much bigger when it was covered in yellow. And the lines had a dramatic effect on the viewing of the landscape as well. So I was seeing all of this again as I was driving through the landscape a lot during spring to visit my mum. And at the same time, I started banding bowls. And I kind of went, ah, that's what I'm doing. I'm putting colour and line onto a ceramic bowl form, and it's affecting the way it appears. It's affecting the volume of the bowl, and it's affecting the way the shape appears. So that's what the practice became about. It became about the perception of color and line on a ceramic bowl form, inspired really by the arable landscapes of North Nottinghamshire.
That is lovely. Yeah, it's very interesting how our backgrounds often come to the fore with this work that we do, right? And that sometimes we have to figure that out and find that in our work.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I just remember as a child there was a field up the road. We used to walk the dog and we'd walk up the road and we'd pass this field and then walk through the woods. But this field was arable in nature, and it changed. So I remember walking past that field and just feeling a sense of just kind of joy and wonderment, looking at the lines and the sense of perspective and the way that made me feel. It was almost as if I felt sort of almost projected across the space by the drama, the dramatic effect of the lines. And that still excites me today. I'm still thrilled when I see a stripy field, and it just, it doesn't go away. So yeah, I've been doing. I went. My dad now lives in Sheffield, actually, and very, very close to the Yorkshire Dales. So last summer, I took myself off in the car and started sketching, and it was a really similar kind of landscape, a little bit more dramatic. It's quite rolling arable landscape in Nottinghamshire. It's more dramatic, more hilly in the Yorkshire Dales, I'd say. But very, very similar. And I just was sort of agog the whole time. I was just going, I've got to stop my car here. I've got to stop my car over there. I'll just draw that and I'll draw this. It was just wonderful to see the different colours and the lines that affect the viewing of a space.
Absolutely. I can see the joy and I hear the joy in your voice as you talk about it. So you didn't take any photographs, it sounds like. You drew pictures. Is that part of your process as opposed to doing photographs?
I did take photographs
Oh,
as
you did.
well, actually. Yeah. I took quite a lot of photographs of one space. A little bit like David Hockney's photo montages. I did that. Took lots of photographs and kind of like pieced them all together. And I've only just started drawing again. It's been a long time. I had my son 13 years ago now, and Every time we'd go up to Sheffield, we'd just go and visit play parks and find ice cream, you know. So, but now he's a little bit older. I'm allowed to go off by myself and look again and draw again. And I was quite nervous when I started doing it. I spent a day making what I thought was awful things, awful sketches. And then the day after, I just tried again, and I started using pencil crayons and changed the medium. And yeah, coloured pencil crayons have always been one of my favourite ways of sketching. So I went back to that, and it was easier. And I found myself again with the drawing. And yeah, and I'm hoping to kind of develop some new colourways from those drawings and put it into my ceramics,
Nice.
probably next year.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Working on some. Textiles, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So you did your master's degree at Cardiff and you had this epiphany, I guess, happen with the instructor who moved you in a different direction. And you went back and did a PhD. Tell us about that.
So the same tutor said to me that. So typically in ceramics, I think people have been interested in how to create color, as in the chemistry of color. And it hasn't really been looked at in research in terms of the perception of color. So the way color is perceived, the way it can alter space. So I had to kind of do a little bit of groundwork and look at other ceramicists who use color. And it hasn't. No one's really looked at it in terms of perception. There's not really anything written on it. So he said to me, "Well, there's a PhD there if you want to do one." I'd never really given it much thought doing a PhD. But he said to me that I could write well enough, which is again something I didn't know. So it's quite interesting how many, I was 30 and I was realizing these things, these hidden kind of skills that I didn't know I had. I was like, "Oh, okay, well, if I, I'll." That sounds like a good plan. And I was really enjoying the learning. I think having been a teacher for 6 years, and really felt what it was like to work, to be back in a position where I was learning again was just really exciting. So this same tutor, with him, we applied for some funding. So I got a funded PhD. So there was, there's no reason not to do it really. And he was then my director of studies. And the PhD was about looking at the way colours affect the perception of the three-dimensional ceramic conical form, specifically the conical form. And we chose, well, I chose that shape because with a curved shape, if it's convex or concave, there's an emphasis on the inside or the outside. But I felt that with a strictly straight-walled form, a conical shape, you could see the inside and the outside more equally. And I was really interested in the relationship between the inside and the outside. So, and you have to kind of limit your parameters a little bit when you're doing a PhD. You can't go off too broadly or it just gets too big. So we stuck to the conical shape. And yeah, I did some sort of field studies in a place in Brecon called Table Mountain. And then later on, I went out to Switzerland to a place called Lucerne to look at the Rigi Mountain, which is a mountain that Turner painted. And there's these lovely three paintings by Turner called the Blue Rigi, the Red Rigi, and the Dark Rigi, all painted at different times. And they all look completely different. So in terms of space and how big they look, how small they look, how far away, but they're actually all painted from the same spot and on the same size kind of canvas. So I went out there to kind of do my own field studies of the Rigi and compare the light and the colours to Turner's paintings. And then I used that to base some of my own work on. So I've created a series of bowls called the Rigi. And they were kind of like the final kind of practical things that I made on the PhD. But yeah, I discovered some interesting things. I discovered an interesting illusion that I called the tilt effect. So on the inside of the wall, It was just where you've got two wide bands next to each other. So it's not really stripy. There's just what this one edge between these two wide areas of colour on the inside of the bolt form. At that point where those two bands meet, the top band appears to tilt backwards. And it's quite a strong illusion. It just kind of tilts and curves backwards. So I called it the tilt effect. And yeah, it's just that was probably the main finding from my PhD. And I've used it a little bit since, and you can see it in some of the artworks that I make now.
Very cool. What else did you learn from your PhD that really you begin to apply to your work today? Aside from what you've talked about already, what else gets applied?
I mean, the notion of ambiguity came into it quite a lot. So the sense that when you're looking at a landscape and it's always changing, it never really seems the same every time you go back to it. And that sense that it is the same, but it doesn't appear the same. So the sense that you have this form, you have a bowl form, and the viewer probably knows it's a conical shape, but it doesn't quite look conical because it's being pulled and drawn in this direction or the other. So this sort of sense of ambiguity became quite a key feature of things that I was making, and really, it's kind of like a positive aesthetic in art. I looked at other artists, I looked at sculptors, and then this notion of ambiguity is something that artists use to kind of, I don't know, as the main sort of aesthetic of the piece. It kind of draws people in and makes them question the form. It's like a visual conundrum. So that was something that I kind of looked at. And I think the other thing it did was it made me really, really look, and it made me really look at the comparisons between a group of bowls. So to find things out, so for example, like the tilt effect, I did several bowls, several different shapes. I started off with this with a cylinder, and then I made a tilt, a conical form that was that only had a slight angle, and then another one with a lower angle and a lower angle, and so on, and painted exactly the same colours on each one to compare which shape gave the best effect. So that kind of idea of comparison, where you have a series of forms, a series of the same shape or slightly different shape but the same surface, that was kind of like something that I looked at quite a lot, and I think have used since. I like making groups of forms now and looking at the relationship between a group of forms. Yeah, and then I think the other thing is the writing. I think a little bit like conversation, a bit like the way we're talking now. I think when you have a conversation with somebody about art or your art, it can help you realize what it's about before you've verbalized it. Sometimes you don't know until you start to talk, and I found the same thing with writing. As soon as I sit down and start typing or writing with a pen and thinking and looking at the artwork, it helps me get to know it, and it helps me realize what it's about and sometimes where ideas have come from, because quite often it's intuitive and you don't know at the time. So the writing was a really kind of useful tool, and it's something that I still use today. Just sometimes I'll just sit down and just have a look at something and see what comes, see what happens.
Right on. The thing that I'm hearing you talk about is kind of an experimentation that you have with your work, that whether it's in the writing, that's I'll call that an experiment when you're starting to think about it a bit more, and the playing with different forms and looking at the colors and the effect that that has on the perception of the piece through that sort of I'll almost call it a scientific approach to the work.
No, I think it is. I think that's what the PhD kind of allowed for. It allowed me that time to really, really explore and experiment, and to really, I was supposed to really push an idea. I mean, I looked at the tilt effect a lot. There were quite a lot of bowls that looked at that referred to that and looked at it, and I examined that idea. And yeah, I'd actually that's a really good point. I'd not thought that. I do work like that now. So like the Saturn collection, which is I'm still making Saturn bowls now. That started 5 years ago, and it's my longest standing kind of probably most successful collection of works kind of to date. But it keeps on going, it keeps on growing. I get to the point where I finish a body of work and I think, oh, I've had enough of that. I don't need to do it again. I'm bored of those colours. And but then I have a break and I come back to the drawing board again. I go, oh, actually, but I've not tried it. If I do it on that shape, or if I use the same colours but in a different arrangement. I think it did teach me to really, really interrogate an idea and get more out of it, because it's surprising, I think, the amount that you can do that.
I mean, I think that's really good learning for people who are listening to this, is to think about their own work and how they could begin to apply that methodology of really getting into it in a deep way and trying multiple iterations of form and color to experiment with their thought.
Absolutely. It's sometimes it's just changing a little thing, and looking at a nuance, and it moves it forward in ways that you wouldn't imagine, and then one thing leads to another, and before you know it, it's sort of 5 years later, and you're still on the same collection. You think, how did that happen? But yeah, I've got some pieces I just made recently for an online sale that I'm really happy with. I really, really like, and I'm like, and all I did was change the color of the rim and change the angle. So I'm working with angular shapes now, and I just changed the shapes a little bit. But the proportions, by changing the proportions a little bit, the whole form seems very, very different. And by changing that one color on the rim, it just has a huge impact. And I think when you start, you delve so deep sometimes that all those little things, you notice the differences that they make.
Absolutely. And that's what makes it so special. Yeah, absolutely. Now, your work, for people who haven't seen your work yet, is bright colors on white. And so, can you talk, not all, it's not always white, but a good portion of it is white. Can you describe for people your work and what they will see when they look at it?
So they're thrown shapes on the wheel, but then
Oh,
I
I've
throw them
lost.
as thin as I can pieces.
Sorry, I've lost you on
Sorry.
your our connection died, so I lost you partway through that sentence. Could you start again? So you said that I'd asked you about the color and what they looked like, and could you describe it? Can you start that again? For
Yeah,
some reason,
that's
we
great.
died. I'm going to shut my camera off
Yeah, sure.
because
So,
that might help. There.
okay. Yeah, so they're thrown on the wheel, and so a conical, a lot of them are kind of conical shape, or what I tend to do is kind of sometimes I'll make a conical shape, and I'll push the wall out and in slightly to make a kind of wave shape to the wall. Sometimes I'll push the wall out quite definitely, and make much more of an angular shape, to the wall. And I take them off the wheel and then put them back on when they're leather hard and turn them. So the walls end up being quite fine. They're quite thin pieces. And I turn the rim so that it curves on the inside side just a little bit to the outer edge. So there's a quite a nice edge, which helps me to paint the inside against the outside. Actually, it helps me to get that nice crisp line around the rim. And then I band them, usually with bright colours, not always. So I hold a brush still as the wheel's going round, and I band different colors on next to each other. If I'm doing, say, like yellow next to like an orange, what I might do is band the whole section in yellow to start with, like a wide section, and then paint the orange bands on top. Some of the bands are quite fine, some of them are really only like a millimeter or so wide, and other so they tend to vary up to that, you know, to about maybe a centimeter in width. And they're quite dry, so the surfaces are not glazed. I use underglaze. And I've tried them with glaze on. And what happens is, if they're shiny as well as highly kind of coloured and banded, all that happens is it's quite difficult to look at because the shine has quite a glare. And you kind of get vertical glare lines, kind of reflectant lines against the bands of color that are going around. So I don't use a glaze. I just use an underglaze and keep them nice and matte, so you can read the colors and the effects. You can read the effects more easily that way.
Yeah, I love the non-glazed surfaces as well. But I'm intrigued with some technical things with your work, in the sense that your work has such fine lines. I mean, they're exact. And I know that's a challenge with a brush sometimes, is to get that exact line. How do you do that? What's your, without giving your secrets away, of course, but what, how do you do that?
Yeah, I think I mean, I've been doing it for a long time. I've been doing it for 20 years. So they've got more precise and finer as the years have gone on. But what I do basically is I rest my arms on the wheel tray, just in quite a natural position. And as a wheel is going round, I paint with my right hand, my elbows are on the wheel tray, and I hold my right wrist with my left hand, and I hold the brush steady onto the form as it's going round. So it's a slightly different action for the inside and the outside. The outsides are a little bit easier. The insides, I have to kind of like prop my elbows up a little bit higher and tilt the brush down lower into the shape. But yeah, I mean, I think over the years you get to know what the right thickness of paint is to get an optimum line. You know, if it's too thick, it won't flow off the brush properly. But I think that all just comes with experience. If it's too watery, if it's too thin, then you know, it might just kind of like you might get a blob as well, just kind of ruining the lines. So yeah, it's just yeah. Time, I suppose, and practice.
Yeah, for sure. Now, what's your approach to the selection of colors that you use? That's obviously very well thought through for you. How do you think about the palette, I guess, if we use that word, to in your approach?
So I started off looking at landscapes, and I think my very first body of work, going back to the MA, was called Arable Landscape. And at the time, I was looking at the landscape. There were lots of I was seeing poppy fields and quite a lot of orange. So the colours came directly from that, and I was interested in at the time referring to the outside as the sky and the inside as the land. So on that particular body of work, there's a dark green and a light green, which are on the inside to represent the land, and also the red and the orange. But then on the outside, there are two blues with the same red and orange, because I always kind of get this sense that, I don't know, colour is kind of reflected in sky and sky reflected in colour. And I think I was trying to get that across with that body of work. I made a piece called Storm around the same time with some really lovely dark blues and yellows and lime greens. I've made a small body of work called Yellow, about yellow rape seeds fields. One of my current, the two current collections I'm working on, one is called Saturn, as I've mentioned, and the other one is winter. So I kind of hold with the fact that the majority of my work stems from the idea I discussed about landscape and color changing form. So, and colors come directly from landscape. Sometimes they come from color theory and color theories that I read about. But Saturn comes from a commission that I got from through Joanna Bird Gallery in London. So in 2019, Joanna asked me to make a commission for NASA because they wanted an artwork to auction at the 2019 anniversary celebrations for the Apollo moon landing, the 50-year anniversary. So she was asked to find an artist to make an artwork that represented space in some way. So she asked me to fulfill it, and I made Saturn. And during my research, I found this fabulous picture of Saturn seen through an infrared lens, which shows colours that the naked eye can't see. So it got this fabulous kind of turquoisey blue, a dark blue, a red, an orange, and a limey kind of yellow. And I immediately knew that it was a really good colour combination. So I made Saturn Bowl back then. And I'm still, as I mentioned earlier, still making Saturn. So that was quite an unusual place. I never expected a colour palette to come from anything like that. I didn't think I would be making bowls about space. But yeah, I mean, but yeah, it is. It was really exciting, and it still is, really. You know, to kind of I've just shown with Joanna Bird recently, and it was quite nice. She had a 30-year exhibition, anniversary exhibition, and I showed some of the current Saturn pieces in that exhibition. So it was kind of nice. It had come kind of full circle. It came from her, and Saturn pieces had moved on since then, but they're in that exhibition. And the winter colorway that I work with at the moment, that was just very intuitive and just a selection of colors that I happened upon one day in the studio. I mean, I've got tiles all over the place, kind of all over the studio. And sometimes I'll just sort of be, I don't know, sitting on the wheel, like doing something, and look up and look across at some tiles, and just kind of my eye just sort of selects colours out. And I think, oh, that'll look nice with that colour. And then I move them around, and then I put colours next to each other. So it's very, sometimes it can be quite playful. And I happen to put this beautiful dark green. It's like a very wintry green, dark green, like an evergreen. And a very dark blue and an ice blue and white next to each other, and painted a bowl with those colours. And it wasn't, again, it was one of those things. It wasn't till afterwards that actually I realised what it was, because that year I'd also got a dog in the October, and so I started walking a lot more. And I made these bowls the first winter bowl. I think it was in the January. So I realized that they'd come from my walks. Those colors had come from what I was seeing. So yeah, that's now kind of like the winter collection, which is based on walks with my dog.
Yeah, that's really cool about how you think about color and how you apply color to your work. Do you how does color interplay with form for you?
So color moves in space. So colors, by that I mean, so if you think of a typical landscape painting with a pale blue sky, quite maybe a watery kind of blue, and then the objects in the foreground will be much stronger in color. So blue is typically a recessive color. It recedes in space. Red is the most advancing color, which is why we use it, quite obviously in kind of for alert signs, stop signs, that kind of thing. But it really stands out more than any other color. Yellow is a really expansive color. Yellow just makes things really wide and big. So colors of all different colors have different properties like that. So when I put color onto a form, I'll look at the shape of the bowl, the piece that I've got in front of me, and sometimes it's conscious. I think sometimes it's subconscious, but I kind of make a decision as to whether I'm going to go with the form, with the color, or not. As in, am I going to negate the form, or am I going to emphasize the form? So if there's a, you know, if there's a nice wide kind of bowl. And I want to emphasize the width, maybe particularly at the rim. If I put yellow around the rim, I know that it will really emphasize the width of that and make it seem wider than what it is. If I want to pull it in, I might use a darker color, like a darker blue or a dark green or even a red. But I mean, then, yeah, color is really complicated. I mean, when I did my PhD, I gave some talks about my work and color, and I was at this. Sorry, I just lost my train of thought. There are color researchers throughout the world who look at color from a science perspective, and they still don't understand color fully. So I was invited to talk at one of these events at a congress. And so I was surrounded by color scientists, and I was like the only artist in the room. But they were great. I mean, they really kind of took what I was saying, what my findings, quite seriously. I talked about the tilt effect when I was there. But I mean, I think the point I'm trying to make is that there were kind of these rules about color that you read about color theory, and you kind of think, oh, if I do that, if I put those two colors together, it will do that. And I've looked a lot at the way colors react in space. But the way they react in a room, or the way they react on a three-dimensional solid object, and then the way they react inside a bowl shape, can be kind of different. So it's still like a massive area for research, and I don't kind of look at it with a research head on as much anymore. It's still there because I've had that training, but yeah. Certain colors don't always behave in the way that you think they're going to. Let's just put it that way. So I consciously think, oh, I'm going to try and make it do this, but then it might go and do something else, just because I put it on the wrong part of the bowl form. Yeah,
That's
if that makes
pretty
sense.
exciting in a way that you've got so many variables to play with. I mean, you've got the color itself, of course, but then you've got the shape of the bowl and whether it's on the inside or the outside and the relation of color to that. And then there's the room that it's in that it's going to impact. And of course, the light that's in that room where the bowl sits is also at play.
Yeah, absolutely. All those everything makes a big difference. I mean, there was a funny kind of incident. I suppose 1 year I've been I did a fair. I do fairs sometimes throughout the year, and it was in the summer, and it was in a marquee, and it was a really, really bright, sunny, and a really hot day. We were having a bit of a heat wave, actually. And on my stand, I'd got Saturn bowls, which are my brightest, probably colorway I've ever made, and I'd got winter bowls, which are nice, kind of calm, cool colors. And on the really, really hot day, people were drawn towards the winter bowls. Some people would look at the Saturn colors and go, oh, you know, as if they were just too much on that day. So I only sold winter bowls on that day, and then the day after, I think the temperature probably, I think, halved. We had some really funny weather. So it went down to about 15 or 16 degrees and was quite cold, and people bought the Saturn bowls. They were kind of buying the opposite. So environment, lighting has a huge impact, has it, on the way they look and the way they're read, and
I was talking to a chef one time who talked about how he sells s hot soup mostly on hot days as opposed to cold days. So in a way, it's that same kind of odd relationship between the environment and what we're working with. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
for
it.
sure.
That's interesting. Hey, do you have any what challenges have you experienced? What's one challenge that you experienced and have overcome in your work?
Don't know if I've overcome it. throwing large is a challenge for me. I have kind of overcome it in a way. I wanted to make bigger work. And I went quite a few years ago now, probably 8 or 9 years ago, I went on a large throwing course with Joanna Howells and learned how to grow pots. So you kind of throw a bowl and then you kind of like wait for it to dry a bit and add more on and throw the piece that you've added on with. And you sort of, she called it growing them. And I did that and that was fine. I could do it. But the only problem I found with that was because the bigger you go with clay, the more warpage there seems to be. So when I put the big bowl in the kiln and fired it came out at slightly off center. I mean, all my bowls are slightly off center. There's not one of them I would say that is 100%. It's just you can't really tell because it's not a lot, and the lines kind of take over anyway. but they have to be a certain level of symmetry there for me to be able to hold a brush still and paint them in the amount of banding on each side. So when I've got this big bowl and it's gone off by, maybe about a centimeter, not that you would know, because again, it's if I were to put a glaze on it, then it would be fine. There's nothing wrong with the bowl, but to paint it is impossible. So I didn't really solve that problem that way. And I still haven't really, I'm still struggling with that one. But what I did do is make an assemblage instead. So I made across three shelves an assemblage of 27 bowls and kind of so it was almost like a picture. It's almost kind of like looking at a picture, looking at these 27 bowls in a cabinet that was represented a landscape, like a Yorkshire landscape scene. So yeah, I suppose I kind of overcame the problem a little bit, but not fully. Maybe I just need to practice a bit more.
Well, that's the thing with clay. It seems like it's a constant challenge, right? Of encountering some sort of problem and then finding a way around it. I think
Yeah.
lots of times ceramic artists are great problem solvers.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, one of my ideas at the moment is maybe to work with someone actually, to get someone to throw me a bowl that isn't off, that isn't
Wobbly.
wonky.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I
I
know.
don't.
Yeah, that could be a quick solution to the problem, couldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, a collaboration is
Yeah,
what kind
yeah,
of what
yeah.
I'm thinking actually, because I still like to do it. I still really like to go big. But maybe that'll be the way forward to work with
Right.
someone.
Right on. Hey, do you have any advice for a junior potter or maybe a senior potter who wants to do work similar to yours? What kind of things would you suggest people focus on as they get better at their craft?
To do work similar to mine, or just their
Eh,
own
no, it
work.
doesn't have to be similar to yours. It could be their own work. But I always ask our guests for a little tidbit of advice for people to get better at what they're doing.
I mean, practice and practice re really does, make perfect. But I think the thing that I found really was. I knew I wanted to learn to throw. It was just a feeling. And to go back to those things that I was making on the MA that I didn't like, looking back, and my tutor spotted that. He saw through me straight away. I was cutting bowls up and I was sitting on the table. I was cutting bowls up and reassembling them. It was very static, kind of. I was sitting, I would like cut something and I would score it and I would like paint slip on and then I'd stick it to another bit and like make these things. It never felt very nice inside. It didn't feel right. My body didn't feel right. So, it came out in the work. So It's got to feel right. So if you feel like you're working on something and it's hard and it doesn't maybe feel right, and maybe it's not getting better very quickly, just think about how you feel when you're doing it. And if you don't feel quite right, then maybe that's the wrong thing to practice, because practice does make perfect, but I think you've got to be doing the thing that feels good. You've got to practice the right thing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I hear you there that we can practice the wrong thing. And by practicing the wrong thing, our work's not going to get better. So it's a combination of technical skills, which you get through practice, and having this right feeling, an emotional connection to the piece, at the same time to make it in the right space.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like a gut feeling, isn't it, really? It's that.
Absolutely.
No,
Sarah,
absolutely.
I want to say thank you so much for being here with us today. This has been fantastic. I really appreciate this. The conversation has been fantastic. I hope that people really enjoy your thoughts about your work and get a chance to go and have a look at your work for sure. And the everything will be up on our website in terms of where to find you on Instagram and on your website.
Well, thank you. Thanks very much. It's been lovely to talk to you, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.